Hi, I'm Lauren.
And I'm Charlotte. Our pronouns are she, her.
This is D Myth Turns the Page.
Our special episodes where we grab our me's.
We unleash our inner goddess.
And we traverse the underworld with Emily Wilson.
Hi.
Hello, Emily. Thank you so much for joining us. This is one of the books I was most excited about reading this year when I found out it existed, because this is a myth that we've been meaning to get into for a while. So thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Before we crack on with your book, can you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Yes, I'm Emily H. Wilson, and I've added the H because there's another Emily Wilson who translates Homer. Very famously, and I've spent years, people go, wow, it's so amazing. It's like, you know, I loved your Greek translation of blah, blah, blah. And I have to say, that's a different Emily Wilson. So I just thought, because my book is kind of in the kind of classic space, I'd add the H for clarity, and it hasn't helped one single bit so far. But anyway, luckily for me, she's astounding and brilliant. So, you know, what do I get? But I am trying to, yeah, so I'm a... by day, I am a journalist. I'm the editor of New Scientist, which is the world's leading science mag, and no one's ever taken me to court. And Inanna is my debut novel.
And we're presuming that you love myths as much as we do. What other kind of books do you like to read?
Well, do I really love myths as much as you do? I'm not sure. So some of my favourite books are retellings of myths. So, for example, I don't know if you've read Mary Renault's Theseus duology. Have you read that?
Not yet. It's on my to be read.
Stunning. Yeah. I mean, it's completely stunning. Mary Renault, kind of unbelievable. The critique of her nowadays is she was kind of bad on women, but she was a gay woman who had to put up with who knows what in her own life, and she wrote gay men amazingly. Theseus isn't gay in her books, but. Yeah, so she did, I think the first one's The King Must Die and The Bull from the Sea. And they're retellings of Theseus, of ancient myths. And she makes them feel like history. So I've always loved her books, but a lot of them are just sort of historical rather than necessarily just mythological retellings. And I am also a big sci-fi buff. But also I just like, you know, posh books. I like Hilary Mantel is my queen kind of vibe.
How did you first become familiar with the epic of Gilgamesh? Because I think for people going into mythology, it's not one they tend to gravitate towards. It's not quite as well known.
And also, there's a good reason why it's not that well known, in that it's all taken off like little old clay tablets, and there's loads of lines missing, and it's kind of hot. You know, it's not super easy and straightforward. But my mum was an archaeologist for about 10 years. And so I sort of grew up in a house with that kind of book. And when I, in about 2019, I reread The Epic of Gilgamesh. But until I reread it, if someone put a gun to my head and said, who is Gilgamesh? Where did he live? What is ancient Sumer? I would not have been able to answer any of those questions, really. And I sort of don't blame myself, and I don't blame other people either, because people think about Egypt, it's like Egypt, and Greece is like, everyone knows Greece, whereas Sumer is a civilization that was kind of buried under other civilizations, one upon the other, and all the names are different, and the languages are different, and it's really so long ago that I'm not really surprised that people have never heard of Gilgamesh and ancient Sumer, which is where he was probably a real guy, probably in about 3000 BC. Anyway, so I picked up the Epic of Gilgamesh again in about 2019. At the time, I was like, I'm definitely going to write my first novel now. I'd started Lowe's. This is when I do it. And when I picked up the Epic of Gilgamesh, I'd read Circe that summer on holiday. So I guess I had the idea in my mind of kind of, you know, retelling of a, you know, some amazing woman from the past. So I read Epic of Gilgamesh. I hadn't remembered that he is super problematic on women. I just didn't notice that when I was a teenager. And the second thing I noticed in the story was Inanna. So she's kind of the baddie in the Epic of Gilgamesh, or at least a sort of whiny, vengeful brat who has a massive sulk because he won't sleep with her. And I immediately was mesmerized being that by Inanna. And then I kind of went down internet Inanna hole, and then I ordered every book about Inanna. And then I thought, if Cersei deserved a book, which she did, then Inanna deserved an enormous epic. So that's how my Inanna thing began.
We love a problematic woman. So we're so glad that you've brought her to the forefront for people.
But I didn't buy all that kind of whining about Gilgamesh stuff. I never, it always sounded to me like kind of black propaganda against her. I never bought her. She was the most powerful, and at times the most powerful deity in the world. And I just never bought her running and complaining to her dad about stuff. So she doesn't do a lot of that in my rendering of the story.
Can we talk about your cover? Because it is gorgeous.
It is really nice.
I'm presuming that's Inanna at the front with the wings and the sun behind her.
Yeah. I had nothing to do with the cover. I was really new to publishing, and just, you know, sort of before anything had happened, they were like, oh, we've briefed the cover artist. And then I sort of found out kind of in a sideways way that the cover options were in. And then I just was like, to the editor, I was like, show me the covers, show me the covers, show me the covers, show me the covers. Anyway, then he did show me the covers. I very strongly like that one. Yeah, I really think it's brilliant. And the cover artist, Julia Lloyd, had gone away, done all the thinking, all the research, and it's full of kind of Sumerian little Easter eggs. And I think it's also really beautiful and gorgeous. And it also reminds me, I don't know, there's a classic Octavia E. Butler book, which kind of that reminds me of. So I'm very lucky to have that cover.
And all the little details, and especially as you read the book, you can go, oh, okay, that's, you know, she's got the knees on her arms and.
Yeah, and the star, which is an Inchabar star, really, but anyway. And the star became her symbol later, yeah. Eight-pointed star, yeah.
Stories are sly things. They can be hard to catch and kill. Inanna is an impossibility. The first full Anunnaki, but born on Earth in ancient Mesopotamia. Crowned the goddess of love by the 12 immortal Anunnaki who were worshipped across Sumer, she is destined for greatness. But Inanna is born into a time of war. The Anunnaki have split into warring factions, threatening to tear the world apart. Forced into a marriage to negotiate a peace, she soon realizes she has been placed in terrible danger. Gilgamesh, a mortal human son of the Anunnaki, a notorious womanizer, finds himself captured and imprisoned. His captor, King Akka, seeks to distance himself and his people from the gods. Arrogant and selfish, Gilgamesh is given one final chance to prove himself. Ninshubar, a powerful woman warrior, is cast out of her tribe after an act of kindness. Hunted by her own people, she escapes across the country, searching for acceptance and a new place in the world. As their journeys push them closer together and their fates intertwine, they come to realise that together they may have the power to change the face of the world forever.
And as we've said, your book is the retelling of the classic myth of Gilgamesh. But what does someone need to know about that before picking up your book?
Well, I think that I realised really early on. So I had read the Epic of Gilgamesh, but I was still like massively ignorant about the area and the history and the kind of layering upon layering of like Assyrians and Babylonians and Akkadians. And then when I started writing the book and showing it to people, I became aware that if I was going to write a book for an audience of people who knew anything about this, there would be like six people reading the book. So I needed to, three of them would be Inanna worshippers, and three of them would be the three academics in the world who study ancient Sumer. During the kind of revisions of the books, I just tried like to take out as much as I can. I mean, my kids still complain that all the goddesses begin with the letter N, but I am kind of stuck with a working pantheon, if you know what I mean. So I'm always trying to say, my grandfather, Enlil, who lives in the north, you know. So I really hope that once people sort of, you know, up to their waist in the water of ancient Sumer, that they, I hope they don't. In fact, I think you could probably read it and just think it was a fantasy and not know that it was kind of fantasy, historical, mythological mishmash.
That is funny because I did think, oh, there's Enki and then Enkidu and then Enlil.
I did think
a lot of the names were quite similar, yeah.
Yeah, it's like if you were starting from scratch, you would pick different names. You would like, oh yeah, yeah, all the made up characters have got very different names. Yeah, I got enough people beginning with E. I hope we're not now making it sound like it's hard, because it isn't meant to be hard. I really wanted it to be a romp and an adventure and not hard.
And how well have the original sources lasted, you know, in terms of how complete they are? You've mentioned that there were some clay tablets with bits missing.
Yeah, so the Sumerians, the first writing ever found in ancient Sumer, which is where Iraq is now. And they did their writing in a kind of writing system called cuneiform, and they did it on clay tablets. And then the civilizations that came after, they kind of copied those stories onto different clay tablets. And so sort of kings would have a library and they'd have all the big stories and they'd have them on clay tablets. And the amazing thing about clay tablets is if your palace is besieged, your library's burnt down, pretty much whatever happens, the clay tablets can survive. And so I talked to one archaeologist talking about sort of digging in Iraq in the summer, and she said, if you put your hand in a hole, you come out with a clay tablet covered in cuneiform. And I can't remember when exactly, but a full king's library was found in the region at Nineveh. And loads of what was found there is now in the British Museum. And that's where, that's why we found out about Gilgamesh, and we've got lots of his epic. But because these tablets, they're about the size of sort of my iPhone 1 here, and they're kind of covered with tiny, tiny writing, and then they've had a chip or some of them are broken and they're fragmented. So the stuff about Inanna and Gilgamesh is pretty good, pretty complete. They were like the big stars of those civilizations. And then for kind of thousands of years, people kept copying out their stories. With the other gods, it's much more fragmentary. So I hope anyone can enjoy the books, but I have put little Easter eggs in there for anyone who does really know all the myths. And so there's a scene in the book where a kind of envoy of King Akka comes riding across a battlefield in a scarlet coat. And that's because there's an ancient poem called the Envoy of Akka or whatever. The schoolboys used to copy out in ancient times. There's not much of it really, but I just threw it in there for the fun of it or whatever. So a lot of it is just fragments, few lines here or there, except about Inanna and Gilgamesh, it seems to be much more. They were super popular. And she, of course, became Ishtar, and then kind of bits of her became Aphrodite and then Venus. So she's a massively long-lived goddess. And also, I found out recently from talking to lots of academics that two things. Firstly, she's probably a prehistoric goddess. She was kind of Venus, and everything about her stories indicates that she's a goddess of prehistory. So she's not just probably 6,000 years old. She's, you know, from time out of mind, a kind of origin goddess. And secondly, everyone always said, anyone who has ever heard of Gilgamesh always says that he's the world's first literary hero. But in fact, it's almost certainly Inanna. She is the first literary hero. The first pieces of literature are about Inanna, about a woman, which is kind of mind-blowing, really. So her big story probably is her descent into the underworld. And that probably is the first piece of literature that we have left to us. And that's pretty amazing, isn't it? So she kind of, on numerous reasons, she's a super interesting person slash goddess to have a to write a series of books about.
It's really cool to think that they might find more tablets with to cover the missing bits.
Literally. So there's this big project going on at the moment. So not right now because it's late at night, but at the British Museum, they have photographers who are photographing and digitizing all the clay tablets there. And the kind of some of them are just like little fragments or whatever, which no one has ever deciphered. They're all being uploaded now. There's this international project led by a guy called Professor Enrique Jimenez in Berlin. And he said every month now they're finding a new fragment of Gilgamesh. And because AI is getting involved to kind of piece together the bits of these tablets that are in different museums around the world, Professor Jimenez likened the study of these texts to like monks in the Middle Ages who might any moment in a light in an old library in an abbey find a new piece of Plato. So, you know, like a classical Greek writer. So what at any moment we could find a new story about Inanna or Gilgamesh. So it's kind of weirdly ancient and dusty, yet fast moving and technology driven kind of bit of the humanities right now.
That's really, really cool. Like, we had no idea that was going on.
Yeah, it's huge. In fact, I just wrote a piece which was came out in Prospect magazine yesterday, in which I bore on about all this, many thousands of words, if you want to read them.
I'm sure we won't find it boring. Is there any social context you could give us from the time that would help someone enjoy the book on a deeper level?
Social context. Well, the Sumerians is the world's first, I'm doing bunny ears, high civilization, because obviously hunter-gatherers had a civilization. It's a liminal civilization in that it stands at this threshold between prehistory and history. So it's the very beginning of what we call history. But I don't think it was that much different from kind of now. Like if you went to Uruk, which is the kind of big famous city in ancient Sumer, if you went there in about 3500 BC, which is kind of 2000 years before our oldest bit of Homer, for example, so it's like really ages ago. If you went to Uruk, be about 50,000 people living there, massive siege walls, canals, markets, writing, medicine, law, divorce, you know, like it would not be an unrecognizable world by any means. I think people would mainly be amazed that at the same time as kind of people were like, I mean, kind of roughly speaking, same time as people were like putting up a stone at Stonehenge, the Sumerians were already a kind of powerful series of city states kind of dominating the region, then producing the first literature, the first time anyone that we know has used the wheel. They came up with 60 minutes in an hour and 12 hours in a day, and so many of our ideas today are taken directly from Sumerian, that we think of as normal things in our lives.
You mention in your author note at the end of the book that this book is not historical fiction. It's, you know, you focus on the myth element rather than the historical element. So why did you decide to do that creatively?
Because it is a, you know, it's a thing when you mash up genres a bit. So Robert Silverberg is a famous sci-fi writer, wrote a book called Gilgamesh the King in the 1980s, which I haven't read because I didn't want his Gilgamesh. I'm going to guess his Gilgamesh is really different from my Gilgamesh. I didn't want any kind of pollution. So I haven't read it yet, but I read his note at the beginning. And he said his book didn't sell in the 80s. It's kind of pre-internet because it was this mixture of mythology and history. So, yeah, if you're just going to retell the myth of ancient Sumer, why try to make the world, you've got gods walking around, why try to make the world kind of realistically ancient Sumer in those days? And yeah, why? But it's what Mary Reno did in her Theseus book. She was writing about people from legend, mythological people, Ariadne, all of that, but it was still ancient Greece, and it was recognized to be a real place. And for me, kind of conjuring up a lost civilization, even if you're adding these mythological elements, for me, it makes it much more magical and delicious, you know, to be trying to kind of create some connection with our deep past. For me, it's just more yum, yum, yum.
And you've mentioned this briefly at the beginning, but is there any evidence that Gilgamesh was a real person?
So there is. I mean, it's not brilliant. There is a list in existence called the King List, which is a list of kings of Uruk. And he is on that list, Gilgamesh. So if I had to put money on it, I would say he was a real king in about the year 3000, by which time, of course, Inanna was already established as a goddess. So, but that's the interesting thing about the myths. You've got someone who's probably real, Gilgamesh, a real king, and he doesn't have any supernatural abilities, and he's in the stories. But then he's walking around in a real world with the goddess. The gods are walking around. They live in their temples. So, yeah. So my book kind of reflects the myths, if you know what I mean. They're like real people who have their own stories, but their stories also intertwine.
What is, for people who don't know anything about ancient Sumer, the Great Flood that we hear mentioned a few times throughout the book?
In the Epic of Gilgamesh, he goes to the side of the world and he kind of goes and hangs out with Noah briefly. It's not called Noah, but amongst the Sumerian works that have been found is the story of this guy. I am going to say his name wrongly now, but he's like, I call him Uktanapishti in my book. And he's just basically Noah. The gods come to him. They warn him that there's this big flood coming. And there's actually a kind of Sumerian a tablet in existence where the gods give really detailed instructions of how to build the ark. It's a sort of enormous coracle. He builds the ark and the floods come and he manages to save everyone. And it's just the ark story. But obviously it's thousands of years older than the Bible ark story. So when this ark tablet was found in what was ancient Sumer, it caused a sensation. I mean, an enormous sensation in London in the kind of 1850s or whatever, because it changed. At the time, people thought the Bible was literal truth, that the world was about 3,500 years old. And suddenly that stories of ancient Sumer have got this other flood and all these details of the flood story, the same as the Bible, it kind of blew everyone's minds at that time. So when I was mentioning the Great Flood, I was nodding to that Great Flood. And that's why I've got the guy who would become Noah in the Bible is in the book, in my book.
It's interesting that there's flood in ancient Sumer, flood for the ancient Greeks, and then a flood in the Bible. They love it. They love a flood.
All the Sumerian stories and myths got recycled. And so loads of them, there's like a character in book two of this Sumerians trilogy, of which Inanna is one, who became Heracles in Greece. So like Inanna became Aphrodite. There's parallels for all of them, and loads of their stories are repeated. And if you think about Inanna's story about I don't want to ruin it for anyone. I won't say. But she's got a central myth, hasn't she, where she does go down to the dark and then she's resurrected. And you can see echoes in other myths and religions around the world about being resurrected after 3 days and all that.
Why did you decide on multiple points of view? Because it's such an interesting choice. And for me and Charlotte, it really helped us feel like the action's moving forward, being able to jump from character to character.
Well, I began with Inanna and then ran into the technical difficulty of that she's not a fantastic person to narrate all of her own stories for technical reasons to do with plot. I then needed another narrator to pick up the story. So then I was like, who better than Ninshubar? There's not much in the myths about Ninshubar. She, there's nothing about her origin story at all. So I kind of created all of that. She really appears fully formed as Inanna's Sukul in Sumerian, the leader of her armies, her vizier, her right-hand woman. So I thought she was fantastic. And then as it went on, it just seemed really weird to be writing a book set in ancient Sumer, a country six people have heard of, and not to have Gilgamesh in there, because if you don't have it from his point of view as well, you don't see much of him. And it just seems such a shame that he's like alive in the world that I'm putting together, and we're not seeing anything of him. So then I exuberantly added Gilgamesh. And then I have got a couple more main characters in book two. Like, you know how do you know who George Saunders is? He wrote Lincoln and the Bardo, which I've never actually read, but he also does a great Substack on writing and has written a lovely book about writing. And he says that I'm massively paraphrasing, but until you kind of make your little hill of beans or your little shit heap that becomes you and what your book is and the kind of books you write, you don't know, do you? So it turns out I'm a multiple POV person. So there you go.
And whose point of view did you resonate with the most while you were writing?
I suppose at different times, you know how, like, as you're, I don't, are you both writers?
No. Not more than just in at home in my novel that will never be released.
Yeah, same.
As I was sort of revising, you know, you go up and down emotionally about how, whether this bit's working or that, you know, whatever. I really liked Gilgamesh. I liked his humor and like his chaos and his sort of disaster drinking and his just general, you know, it's just like I had fun with Gilgamesh and became very fond of him and went a bit soft on him, really. And then with Ninshubar, she's just like a sort of excellently complicated, competent person. And at times she kind of threatened to eat the book for me because she was so strongly my favourite. But then I think Inanna is the closest to being like me. Do you know what I mean?
So some of the myths you've include Inanna and Dumuzi. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it.
I don't know how to pronounce that. I call him Dumuzi. I'm quite fond of him as well, even though I've got him as a kind of, you know, weak sister shagging shilly shallier. Yeah, I do like Dumuzi, yeah. So yeah, I've got Inanna and Dumuzi's myth. Their marriage. Not a great love match.
No. Her descent into the underworld.
Yeah.
Inanna and the, again, I'm gonna butcher this, Halupu tree and the envoys of Akka into this story. So yeah. Why did you choose these particular myths to be so prominent?
I wanted to create like a universe. And so I read all of them. I read everything there is in existence that's been translated into English and is in any book or on the internet about the main character. So as I said, like, there's the most stuff about Inanna and Gilgamesh. So I wanted to kind of piece together her myths and Gilgamesh's myths and make sense of it in a kind of landscape and a world. And really early on, I was like, I want it to be Cersei / Game of Thrones, like in bar, you know, I wanted it to be a big landscape, lots happening, lots of characters and sort of twists. And so then when as the characters started to grow, I would just use what felt right at the time. And if I decided that I didn't like a myth, I was just like, oh, that's wrong. That's like my, it's like a myth about Inanna where she's in a garden, she gets raped by a gardener, she goes and cries to her dad. I'm like, yeah, that's just rubbish. Just don't believe it. Don't want it. Not in. So yeah, I just made decisions as I went along about what felt right for the characters, you know.
This next question's a bit of a cheat question because it's actually one of the first questions you have in the back of your book for discussion in book club. And I was really curious as to your opinion, your answer. So how do Inanna, Gilgamesh and Ninshubar's background and upbringing impact the way they each view the world?
I think that Inanna has been completely isolated. So her funny, I talk about all this and like they're all real, obviously they're all real people to me and also very serious survey. So in this story, there are these 12 gods or so-called gods, these very long-lived creatures who are basically the ruling elite nation Sumer, the Anunnaki. And they're very, very old and they're meant to be immortal, but they're starting to kind of age and wither. They're quite a corrupt and cynical band, very divided and full of hatred. And the one thing they can't do is have new Anunnaki babies together. And then along comes Inanna, and her mother and father, who are the gods of Ur, which is a big city in the south, they just wrap her up like a piece of china, and their whole lives revolve around protecting her. And so she is really like living in a kind of bubble in a dream world and has been protected from all kinds of realities. But at the same time, she goes to temple and watch her dad having sex with people in their weird Sumerian sex rites. So it's like it's a weird upbringing. Whereas Ninshubar, she's grown up in hunter-gatherer tribe and she has a very realistic sense of what life is like. She's had to really make do and survive to thrive. And she's already had, you know, quite early on in the book, her own mother sentences her to death. So she's had a very different upbringing, and she is very confident in her own abilities, and she's already worked out her like internal she's worked out what's right and wrong for her and how she's going to conduct herself. And for her, the thing she won't submit to stuff, she won't bend her knee, and she'd rather die than do so. So that's Ninshubar. I'm going on really boringly, aren't I, now? And then Gilgamesh, he was born to two of the Anunnaki, who are near immortal, and he came out human, and they've just been devastated by how soon their son is going to die. So it's kind of a prince of Uruk, but growing up with his sort of parents' terrible grief about his mortality. And he kind of went off the rails in early puberty. And when we meet him, he is fully off the rails still and careering from one drunken disaster to another.
That leads us quite well into my next question, which is the fact that the Anunnaki they've still been having children, and some of them have been demigods and some are human, and Gilgamesh is human. Do you think that would have been really hard for him? The fact that his parents are immortal and there's just so much that goes with that. Like Gilgamesh in your book describes his dad's grief as bottomless, and that everything that Gilgamesh did for him was for the last time and imbued with tragedy. And I feel like even unintentionally, that's a lot of weight to put on a child, because obviously Gilgamesh was once a young kid and kids pick up on these things. No wonder he's a hot mess.
Yeah, well, I started to forgive Gilgamesh more and more, because, I mean, don't forget, this is obviously my rendering of it. If you read the Epic of Gilgamesh, it does not start with this kind of like soft, it's just him out taking young girls to his bed. So I think it is a lot, and that's why he's off the rails, and it's only the kind of stuff that happens in the course of the book that he starts to grow up a bit. I mean, I would only say a bit though, but in book two there's a lot more of Gilgamesh's mother, another goddess beginning with N, so I won't even bother naming her. I just call her my mother, you know, when I'm doing Gilgamesh, it's like my mother, which is like nobody needs to know it's another goddess beginning with N. but his mother, Ninsun, she's a big character in book two, and I kind of explore their dynamic, because she's kind of a no-nonsense person.
This is the point of the episode where we get our Sumerian spoilers on. None of the Anunnaki are capable of making you forget them, So they advise you go and read the book before delving into more of their messy family drama.
You've mentioned it already, but let's talk about sex. And more specifically, the temple rites. It was a part of marriage ceremony to have sex in front of the guests. And there were also temple ceremonies where the god/goddess would have sex with someone to help crops grow. Is this real or did you make this up?
Well, people say all kinds of things about the Sumerians and the Anunnaki. If you read the original myth, they are filthy. I mean, filthy. And so everything in the book, although there is sex in the book, I've tried to make it either incredibly kind of slightly off screen, or I've tried to like to make it romantic with some of them while being, I hope you'll agree, not smutty at all. So I've like, I have taken a few lines from the ancient poems, but I've used them more like when Inanna's teasing Dumuzi. She goes, oh, I hope you enjoy ploughing me today, all that kind of stuff. And that's me just, I'm taking the lines from the myth and kind of using them slightly out of place or whatever. So I think that if anyone else ever writes such a prudish book about Sumerians, I'll be astonished. But yeah, there's kind of, yeah, I mean, there's also a bit that I didn't use because I just thought, I don't really know how to use this for a modern audience, where Inanna kind of praises her own vulva at quite a lot of length. And she, look at my beautiful vulva. And yeah, she kind of just really talks in praise of her own sexual organs, and a lot of the hymns as well. It's a lot of, yeah, furrows being ploughed and the milk of the god sowing beauty into the land. Yeah, so nobody knows what really went on in their temples, but you know, there's nothing that I did that wasn't a kind of watered down guess.
Well, you have the two priestesses explaining to Inanna what to expect. Yeah. And yeah, what I did find interesting was their view of sex was fine, but as soon as it became an affair, that was no.
Yeah. What I felt with Inanna was that she's been brought up seeing her father in temple, her mother in temple, knowing about what the temple stuff is all part of the Anunnaki's, their kind of controlling of the world and the discourse, and also wanting to sort of spread their Anunnaki seed everywhere. And everything that happens in temple, I think from Manana's point of view, it's incredibly, it's controlled, it's in front of witnesses, it's laid down, they never veer off path. It's completely known, predictable, and not, I mean, nerve-wracking the first time, but not frightening for her in the way that someone brought up in a normal way, in a normal place would be. Whereas for, I think for Inanna, anything that happens kind of in private is full of a whole different set of emotions and trepidation and even terror. So it's like, for her, the temple stuff is what she was raised for. I know it's really weird, but like, yeah, if you read the myths, you'll be like, oh, she'd make it up. They're quite strong. In fact, there's only a couple of lines in the book where I got queried by my editor going, this is a bit much. And both of them were, one was about a torture method with tar, and it's like, well, yeah, just that's like, those are what the lines that were sort of mentioned were the lines directly taken from the stories. Yeah,
we have more questions about the temple rites in a little bit.
Everything's 99% made up, but I'm just inspired by a riffing of the poetry, if you sort of mean it.
Well, we'll get back into that in a minute. But Ninshubar, yeah, she says that there's no greater honour than hunting at the back of the group.
Yes.
What's the significance of this? Because I felt like it was quite interesting, because normally with animals, we think of the weakest being at the back.
So, because this is a 3-book arc, everything that's there is there for a reason later on. But so with Ninshubar, I saw a film a few years ago of a hunt on foot. I don't know if it was in, I can't remember where it was. It might be in the Masai Mara. and the hunters kind of ran all day with the dogs following a kudu or some kind of big game animal. I think the film's like from the 1960s. And over the course of an incredibly long time, everyone peels off and then the last runner goes on and the animal lies down to die and accepts its fate. It's all very amazing and moving. So I took that for Ninchaba as part of her kind of foundation myth of her sort of extraordinary rise from someone completely outside Bunny Ears civilization to the great place she holds later.
And as we've already discussed, you've added myths into this novel. Gilgamesh and his men encounter Humbaba. Hoping you pronounce it. Who is Humbaba, and is this a real myth, or did you make that up?
The going up onto the into the cedar forest is a kind of core part of Gilgamesh's story. In the myth as it is, they have this sort of complicated journey there. He's kind of racked by scary dreams. And then they get into the cedar forest. There's lots of different versions of it. And then there's this terrible monster, Humbaba. Because I'm kind of rendering the book into the kind of real world or whatever, my Humbaba is not a monster. He's just a last creature of his kind. But the whole of the cedar forest stuff, in fact, most of Gilgamesh's story adheres much more closely to the kind of flow of the myths, just because the work of piecing his story together as an epic has been done over the millennia. You know, the stories that were all kind of just random Gilgamesh stories were made into an epic by the Babylonians. So it was much easier to have a thread with him. It's just the difficulty with Gilgamesh's story is kind of motivation, because, you know, really working out why all these things happened and why he did what he did.
Well, one thing with Gilgamesh is when we meet him, he's a captive. But there were times when he was in captivity where he seemed to be treated almost like a guest. So would that have been for show? Or
so I did that through all of history. You know, people have had royal hostages and have treated them quite well, because as long as they can't get away, they're, you know, people from the elite, people of a similar class. So I didn't think it was. So King Akka has, because obviously Gilgamesh's dad and granddad have been around forever. King Akka's grandfather knew the Anunnaki. They were guest friends, and they had a relation. By the way, everything I'm saying is just in my book, and this is not from the myth. This is just from my book. But they had this relationship going back away. So foolishly, King Akka thought he could trust Gilgamesh hanging out in his court, behave with some honour.
And talking of captivity, Ninshubar was taken to Sumer in your book. Yes. And she remarks, in Sumer, the temples had first choice in slave markets by ancient right, and the price they offered could not be refused. So from what you know of the time period, is this true, or is this something that you embellished?
So just to be clear, because of the difficulty of having gods around, I set this about 500 years. I pulled it back to 4,000 rather than 3,500, because I thought then I'm not going to get into any art. Like when I showed it, I'm just not going to get, of course it's not historically accurate. Yeah. Had I kept it in 3,500, which is about the time I was talking about in Uruk, when there were sort of 50,000 people there or whatever, and not that long before Gilgamesh might have been real. We just don't know any. All we have is some kind of bits of writing. And the myth, we only have much later copies, from much later in time. So it's a guess. But we have, obviously have been digs. And I mention at the end of the book, I talk about the Leonard Woolley's digs at Ur, where they found some of the kind of, if you go to the British Museum, you'll see this treasure from ancient Sumer. And that was found at Ur, things like the Standard of Ur, and sort of grave goods, and possibly what he believed was this huge mass grave, which is where I got the inspiration for some of the bad stuff that happens in the book, which is, but also there is a myth about Gilgamesh, which backs up the archaeology, which is, there's a story about when he dies, he's laid out with his family all around him. And Inanna diverts the Euphrates so that he can be buried underneath it, and then the river can flow over again. But the point is, the gruesome bit is all his family laid down to be buried with him. So I think that was a thing. Yeah, so what I've tried to kind of make it historically right, but it is outside history. It's so long ago that it is a kind of, it's like I've tried to dream up something that feels right.
But that's what I enjoyed. I liked the fact that it could have been real. We don't know. We don't know that they didn't do that.
And then there are bits where I think I said in the back of the book where I really wanted my heroes to ride around on horses, but they didn't have horses in ancient times. And then after a while, I was like, well, they had horses on the steppes of Asia. Like, maybe Gilgamesh's dad imported some. So he did. Then Gilgamesh gets to ride a horse. And maybe one day they'll be found in the archaeological record, not those sort of weird looking mule things. But anyway, whatever. Yeah, and I did look up, you know, were there hippos?
In your book, Ninshubar was known to speak 14 languages.
Yeah.
But why did they struggle to learn Sumerian? Is it notoriously difficult or?
Well, there's two things there. Firstly, I was hinting at the fact that Sumerian is an isolate, which is that it appears to come from nowhere and it has no relationship to any other language. So I was hinting at, and people have always found that very odd and suspicious. And people who've leaned into the Anunnaki or aliens kind of conspiracy theories and stuff, that's part of it. So for me, I've got this story where the gods come down from heaven with a language. And so Ninshubar is a highly proficient linguist. She's used to the languages of the African continent that she's kind of been traveling through. But then she comes to Sumer and she doesn't recognize any of the language. So that was I was pointing to that. But I mean, of course, she learns it very quickly and is then obviously superb at it, as she is everything.
Inanna meets Enki, who gives her two lion cubs, and he charms her. And yeah. She's initially weary as she's heard that he's done some terrible, terrible things.
Terrible things.
He tells her when she's a great goddess, people will make up lies about her. So do you think, in the case of your story, this is a case of idle gossip amongst citizens, or is it smear campaigning against, you know, the royals?
Well, what I was thinking about then was that of the six people who know about Inanna, maybe seven, there's just stuff in her mythology which to me reads as someone kind of darkening her name, you know? Like when Gilgamesh refuses to sleep with her, she has this massive strop and complains to the male gods, and they, you know what I mean, they help her. And also, you know, the rape in the garden that I mentioned, there's like stuff in there. I was thinking about stuff like that, like, you know, who knows what. Anyway, of course, she wasn't a real person, so it's all moot. But I guess I was pointing to the fact that who knows what kind of ideas, the people who copied down those myths and changed those myths over thousands of years, God knows what kind of mindset they had or what they thought about women or whatever, you know. And Anna, if she ever existed, which she didn't obviously, has no control over what we find out about her today.
We did an interview with Honor Cargill Martin, and she was saying that sometimes the rumours and the bad things that people say can tell us just as much, because it shows you what they're sort of interested in. Even if they're not true, it shows you what they might have believed or what they enjoyed.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, yeah, absolutely. The Sumerian myths are just handfuls of poems. I can't tell you enough, like, how much it is, the book is just made up. It's just made up, you know. Yeah, but I guess it's kind of made up through a prism of having sort of lived and breathed all that mythology, I guess.
Well, taking it just from your book now, do you think she was wrong to be charmed by him? Or do you think he is a very charming person when he wants to be?
I think Enki is, yeah, he's incredibly charismatic person, and he's a lot more of a book too. Yeah, he's a very charismatic person, and there are bits about him that are guest charming, and that he's like super, you know, he's like an enthusiast. He's super enthusiastic about his gambling. You know, he collects but he collects carpet and stuff like that. What he collects is stuff from the British Museum. He's just copying it out from there. But he also, since he's sort of come down from heaven, he treats it a bit like a computer game, where he's like, to him, he's the only real person in it, and his actions don't really have any consequences. And you know, so I don't know what you'd call that kind of person, but he, I don't know, I guess he's a sociopath, I guess you would call it. But he's not without his good point as well.
Well, Inanna goes with Enki so that she can be married to his son. But when she's first told, you know, that Enki thinks this is a good match, she's not very impressed. And I think the response is, oh, he's a sheep. He's a sheep god.
God, yeah.
And I don't know. I don't really blame her. So in your opinion, as obviously her creator, do you think she's too good for Dumuzi?
Well, Dumuzi's got no interest in her at all. He's madly in love with his sister, Geshtinana. However you pronounce that. He's madly in love with his sister. It's a political alliance. He's hundreds of years older than her. None of it's her choice. She didn't want to leave home. She didn't want to leave home with Enki. She didn't want to get married to his son. She's no agency at all in any of it. And it all sucks big time. So, I mean, as you know, in the myth, they kind of paint Dumuzi and Inanna as a great love affair. But the fact that she then, in the myth, sentences him effectively to death and sends him to hell is an indicator that it wasn't just sweet love, right? So that's why I told the story of them having more difficult relationship and not a great marriage at all. In fact, obviously she's having a massive affair with Gilgamesh for the meaningful part of their marriage, so.
It felt more real the way that you wrote it.
But he's only a sheep god because they've given him that silly title. You know what I mean? He's not like, I don't think he's ever, you know, looked after a sheep or anything. He's a pan. Actually, I don't mind Dumuzi in a way.
I didn't hate him. I thought, okay, yeah, he's been told to marry Inanna.
Yeah.
No, I didn't like him.
And he's obviously in love with his sister, but I didn't hate him.
It's really difficult, isn't it? Because with your own characters, I really let them off a lot. in book two, obviously his circumstances are very different from in book one. As time's gone on, he has amused me more and more, Dumuzi. Yeah, but there was a little bit where he said to his dad about they're trying to get Inanna's weapon off her wrist. And he's like, should we cut her arm off or something like that? And I think Inanna found that very difficult to forgive.
There's a point as well where he says to her, oh, he's been out all day doing whatever. Yeah. He's like, oh, I've been thinking about you. Kind of like, I'm sorry, I sort of compared you to my sister. Actually, your body's quite nice. I was like,
yeah,
it's not really a compliment at all. Is he just rubbish with women, or I don't know?
Yeah, he's like, he's a nightmare. Yeah, yeah, he's like, I didn't fancy you before, but now that we have sex regularly, I used to think you were really weird looking, but I don't mind it anymore now. And I'm, you know, having sexual thoughts about you. Yeah, he's a nightmare. Obviously, those that say nightmare. he's not love's young dream, but I mean, as he does pay a price for that.
But I didn't think that he particularly treated her badly. He just wasn't that into her because he was told to marry her. I didn't necessarily take it as it was a bad marriage. It just wasn't one that was meant to be.
Yeah, well, he that's how he sees it from his point of view. He's like, well, I'm subject to my dad too. I've got no choice about this either. It's not what I'd want. I'm doing the best I can or whatever. It's like, was he really? Would Ninjabar have behaved like that? No. He didn't need to lie to Inanna about how her mother was being treated. And he, yeah, I think he's kind of, at least in book one, a really kind of morally bank, well, I guess, yeah, a bit lost, but morally bankrupt, you know.
There's something else that he does later that I don't like, which we'll get onto in a minute. But going back to the sex rites at the beginning that we mentioned when we got into spoilers, Inanna is told when her marriage is upcoming by the priestesses that she needs to put on the best show she can, basically, and just fake it. Yeah. However loud she's being, it's not loud enough.
Yeah.
And is this a real sort of thing that it needed to be a big over-the-top performance?
We're in totally made-up land. All we have is ancient poems which are filthy and seem to celebrate sex as sort of part of the religious thing, and I've rendered it into something. But what I was trying to go for then was that Inanna completely understands that it's a performance and the nature of the performance. She's been raised to that as a performance, but the lines of what she said are taken from a different part of the story. I took them from when, in the original, Ereshkigal was in a terrible state when Inanna goes down to hell, and she's like, is she in labour? What the hell's happening with her? And she screams out these lines over and over about, oh, my insides, oh, my outsides, or whatever. And I was really taken by those lines and that kind of, that shouting and screaming, and I've kind of reused them for her in her kind of temple thing.
I found it really surprising because we always think through history that sex is all about the man's pleasure and not about the woman's. And here we have a goddess being told she needs to play like, she needs to display like top tier levels of pleasure in this quite awkward moment, because the first time she's performed for an audience like this.
I mean, the nature of how it played out and what that was all about is made up. But I think in the poems, it's clear that in the worship of the goddess Inanna and the stories about her, where there was a definite celebration of female sexuality. And as I said, like when Inanna goes on and on and on about how wonderful her vulva is. But also the fact, don't forget, at the moment in the UK where I live, like the kind of main god is a you know, a man. We haven't celebrated female goddesses for quite a while in this country, maybe, I don't know, 1500 years or whatever. And Inanna was for a long time the most powerful god in that area of the Middle East. And I think if you're going to work, if your main god is a woman, female pleasure and female sexuality is going to be celebrated alongside that woman, isn't it? Makes sense.
But then why did you write it that when Enki sleeps with his wife in the temple as part of the temple rites, she's basically unresponsive?
Oh yeah, like a dead rabbit. It's just like, well, she's just not, I guess she's just a character in a book, isn't she? And she, you know, Enki's run through his wives, and not much of that wife survived into book one. Initially she had sort of more of a part, she was not super nice to Inanna. But then I just decided there are too many goddesses and some of them had to just hit the cutting room floor. She's just, I guess, gone it too long, nothing in it for her, not interested in putting on a show. And Anna felt differently about it, different place in her life. I've got to say again, all made up.
Yeah. But we're acting like it's real, so.
Yeah.
That's me. Whenever I hear anything about Nana now, I'm like, well, actually, that's a little bit raw.
I'm going to look so sex obsessed here. In your book, Gilgamesh tells Inanna that she doesn't have to use a lottery system to find a man for the temple rites, that it's custom, but it's not the law, which really seems to piss off the priestesses.
Yeah.
But she decides, to no one's surprise, oh, okay, well, I'll do the temple rites with you, Gilgamesh, then, since, you know, you've had the idea.
Yeah, that's a brilliant idea, yeah.
So, which I assume was him giving her that option.
Yeah.
So it happens. But then, and this is the other thing DeMuzy does that really pissed me off. I get the impression he was trying to make her feel bad about it. He's kind of like, oh, I heard that you did that ritual with him. And then he tells Inanna how stunning Gilgamesh's actual wife is. Like, he's trying to put her down.
To hurt her. Yeah, Della. Yeah.
Is he jealous? Is he just being a dick?
He's jealous. Yeah, he can't help it. He's jealous of Gilgamesh from the first time they have dinner together. And Inanna's basically starstruck. And she's like, oh my God, I spent my whole life hearing stories about you. And she's just instantly captivated by Gilgamesh. And DeMuzy is instantly really, really fucking irritated. And then he hears that they've been kind of hanging around the city together. And then when he goes away, she sleeps in temple. I can't remember what Gesh Dinana had, some kind of horrible put down of her. Yeah, so she's become his personal property. And yeah, he does try and hurt. Yeah, he's mean.
Is it just like a property thing, do you think? Or are his feelings hurt? Is it more because you're mine, he can't have you? Or does he care a little bit?
Like, he just feels a bit jealous, you know? He didn't like seeing her come alive, you know? It's the first time that Inanna has really, you know, like, since the time when she's been taken away from home against her will, she's lived and she's sublimated all her kind of anger and wants and a lot of other stuff. And Gilgamesh kind of unlocks the bit of her that wants stuff. And DeMuzy sees that coming, you know, that makes DeMuzy feel jealous. Yeah, definitely.
I loved the bit at the dinner where he sort of says something. This isn't word for word from the book, but basically like, oh, you're being quite chatty this evening, because she's trying to talk to Gilgamesh.
But also before that, she hasn't spoken for about 3 months. She's been like completely silent, not speaking to DeMuzy ever. And he's just talked to her and hasn't really minded very much. And then suddenly she's like, Gilgamesh turns up, and then I was like, chat, chat, chat. Suddenly like able to talk again. So I think that's what he was pointing at. Yeah.
Inanna meets Ninhursag, and she gets told that Ninhursag tried to leave Enki.
Yeah.
So in return, he had meted out brutal violence against her and her girls. And we heard this earlier in the book as well, that that Enki had done this, which we said
it's one of the foundation myths of Sumer.
It's so grim.
And it's so much that, I just made it part of, like, I just made it kind of part of the framework of whatever without going into it all. But yeah, like Ninhursag and Enki it's like dark, dark, weird stuff. Yeah.
Inanna finds out that this story is being told as a lesson for all the wives. Now, regardless of whether this is true or not, obviously it was in the myth, but whether it was actually used as a lesson, how do you think that your Inanna would have felt about this? Because, again, like, the man that she meets and the stories that she hears are quite disparate at this point. Yeah. But it's also quite scary that this is the kind of thing that someone will do. They'll do like the worst thing they can to hurt you.
And that is Mark Ningle. They've all got bloody end names. Ningle has grown up with this awful father and then also awful husband. The gods in the north think she's like this backbone free traitor to goodness, you know. She sort of stayed down in the south with these awful people, and she didn't, you know, her kids have left her, she didn't, she could have done a lot more, Ningle. But Inanna knows how bad Enki is because she's seen how frightened her mother is of him, so although she's never met him before, but I think kind of hearing stories and then seeing the reality is two different things, isn't it? Especially, she's just really young still.
he's very clear, Enki's very clear to make the distinction to Inanna that, oh, they weren't actually my daughters. They were the daughters of somebody else. I just raised them like daughters.
Yeah.
Is he trying to justify his actions to himself, to Inanna?
He's just spinning her a line. He's just like, he's just spinning her a line. He's charming her. He's deliberately charming her. He's collecting her like one of his lovely tables.
So he's trying to lie to her, not to himself.
He's grooming her, really, in modern parlance. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. He's horrible.
Oh, the fact she sleeps with him. Oh.
Sorry. Yeah, that was grim.
Sorry. But I'm like, I've toned everything down. I mean, like, not toned it down, but I've just, you know, it's bad things. Like, it's a pretty dark. I hope that, you know, the myths are dark. Bad things happen in the night. But the thing about Inanna, I hope people will realise that she does ultimately triumph by becoming the longest-lived female goddess in history. So, you know, hold on. It's only the beginning of her story. She, you know.
Yeah. It was the bit where she ended up on his lap. It was like, oh, really?
But you could see the lions
were on his lap.
Okay.
So he leant over and he kissed a lion and it's lying on her lap. I think that's what you're thinking of.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I took it as she was on his lap.
What's so frightening for Inanna is in this weird world they all inhabit, what's so frightening is like the stuff that's in private with no witnesses and no kind of map. Is terrifying, but Enki never feels any shame for what's happened because she knows very clearly she's done absolutely nothing wrong. And he doesn't really touch the core of her. I think that her brutal murder, since we're in the spoiler thing, her brutal murder in the underworld, she struggles to get over what happens to her there. That kind of carries on with her for quite a while.
Why did Inanna's sister, Ereshkigal, change her tune after Inanna died? Because she was so convinced before that Inanna was An in disguise.
Yeah. So Ereshkigal, she's now like one of my favourite characters now because she's a big character later on. I don't want to ruin book two, but she had a really hard time and been in really bad pain for like a really long time. Those little flies, which are taken straight from the mist, the little flies that come in, and I've made them, you know, turn into these two kind of supernatural figures. But those flies are from the mist and they have names just like in the mist, Kagura and Galator, I think they are. I didn't know I was gonna be like massively cross-questioned over every bit, but you're good, you guys. Anyway, but I'm pretty sure their names are Kagura and Galator. And those flies help Ereshkigal. So, and they, they're the flies that resurrect Inanna, but they also help Ereshkigal, and in my rendering of the story, because when you read the myth, it's a bit, is she pregnant? Is she not? What the hell is going on with Ereshkigal? But anyway, they kind of do a lot of healing work on her, and she feels very different and in a different place. But also, Ereshkigal is a highly unstable and unpredictable character, that part in the story. And she's still on her own in the dark, kind of creating demons who serve her in a very strange place for hundreds of years, or 100 years. That's very typical of Ereshkigal to flip-flop like that.
I mean, you say she's not a very stable character, but I don't think many of them are.
I think Ninjabar is super stable.
Not many of them.
Oh, yeah. And then... Gilgamesh's mom is Ninsa, all ends. There are stable people. I think Ereshkigal was kind of dragged down to hell and then she's really lost things in the darkness. But Inanna's quite stable, I think. She's just really young, finding her way in the world. I wouldn't say Inanna was unstable. She's just hasn't you know, her leaves haven't shaken out. She's not the full oak tree yet, you know. And she goes through a lot of hard stuff for like 13 or 14, even if she's the daughter of gods, you know.
It did make me laugh that she took all of, she sort of effectively put on a costume to make a grand entrance into hell and then just slowly had to take things off because they weren't practical, and she ended up not wearing any of it, that she struggled so hard to kind of keep nice for the journey.
Yeah, she's getting her strength up, yeah. And that's all like from the myth as well, her having to take off everything as she goes through the gate. Obviously, my gates are a bit different.
Dumuzi's sister, I don't want to attempt to pronounce her name, so I'm not...
I think it's Geshtinana.
I'm not even going to try that.
At least it's a G. At least it's like different from... Mine just got Nana in it, but anyway, whatever, yeah. Let's call her Geshtinana, yeah.
Okay, Geshtinana.
Yeah.
So after Inanna gains her freedom from the underworld, she sends Dumuzi to serve in Ereshkigal's temple because she wants a god to
serve her.
And...
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Well, she's quite clear on that. And Dumuzi's sister, I'm not going to say the name, she asks if they can spend half of the year there each. And she does this as an act of love for her brother.
Yeah.
And Inanna's kind of like, well, you mean nothing to me, so I don't care. It's not really up to me.
Well, yeah, she actually quotes Geshtinana back to herself, where Geshtinana said, when Inanna had no power, Geshtinana said, oh, I know you mean nothing in this. So Inanna says it back to her later in the story, you know, I know you're nothing in this, whatever. She doesn't really care, whatever.
Can you tell us if this happens, or would that be a spoiler for book two?
Which bit?
Whether they're allowed to spend half the year there each. Well, I bet it's a spoiler.
I can tell you that Ereshkigal's a big character in book two, and Dumuzi and Geshtinana are very much part of that story.
So quite possibly then, or if not, I feel like she's going to try and do that. Geshtinana is going to try and do something to get her brother lover back. Oh, so horrible.
Well, yeah, I mean, like a lot of mythologies, and then actual like the pharaohs did the marry and the brother and sister. It's all a bit, you know, whatever.
You don't have to like it, though.
You don't have to like it. You can comfort yourself that they weren't brought up, you know, together or whatever.
It's less grim than the pharaohs.
Wait till you get into the Egyptian gods in book two. They are a bunch of right weirdos with weird stories.
Well, I know that Cleopatra was supposed to marry her brother, and there's such a big age difference between them. He was like a little kid and she was a teenager. Yeah. It's like, this is going too far now.
Yeah, keeping the bloodline pure and all that, yeah.
And that's actually real.
It's keeping the money in the family, isn't it? It's all about power, yeah. So,
real, and it's disgusting. At least,
yeah.
At least Dumuzi and Geshtinana are probably not real.
Yeah. But I guess that's like a demonstration of the fact that you, kids do accept the weird, if you grew up in a Pharaonic family in Egypt and your mum had been married to her brother or whatever, you would just accept this as, in the same way that Inanna accepts all the weird temple nonsense with her dad and doesn't necessarily, I mean, I don't think she particularly likes it, how it gets on with him, but she doesn't judge him over what he does in temple, because it's what she's raised to. God, we're making it all sound really dark now. Please can you like admit that it's also fun and has jokes?
The book's brilliant. The book is brilliant.
It does have jokes. So I really think of it as like a light romp, but now like we're all drilling down into all this, it seems like it's really kind of festival of darkness. But but I felt like obviously there's sad, dark bits, but overall I'd be like, hoo-hoo-hoo. There's lots of characters in it who just like endlessly amuse me.
I love the book. I was endlessly amused by it. I just want to ask you the questions about the book because I love it.
All right. Yes.
Well, we've only got one dark question left.
Oh, okay.
It's not even dark.
I'm just saying, you know. Yeah.
I don't even think it's that dark. I'm just joking.
Okay, yeah.
A character we haven't really mentioned yet is Haga, who tells Ninshubar that he has a lot of gold, and this means that on the other side, when he dies, it will make a better life.
Yeah.
And then she asks, well, does this make a difference?
Yeah.
He said, well, it might only make a small one, but small differences matter when you're somewhere for eternity. Yeah. So what made you add that little...
That is all true to what we know of history, which is that the Sumerians had a pretty grim view. But you can see from the gods they had that they didn't expect a lot from their gods. And they didn't expect a lot from the underworld, but they thought if you kind of, did what you could to kind of gain material goods, blah, 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 things would be better. And people would come and put stuff on your grave or whatever, and it would be like, things would be less bad, but not brilliant. They didn't have I'll be there and I'll be surrounded by lovely virgins and it's not like the halls of Valhalla or anything like that. They had a different kind of world and death view.
But that's something that's even prominent today. Like I know that a lot of Chinese belief is that you can burn like paper versions of things that's meant to be for your relatives that have passed on, and you can even get like paper mobile phones and stuff that you can burn for them. So that's an idea that still kind of exists today, that you can do things for your loved ones that have passed on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm basing this all on the history books that I've read, but I think that Haga comes from a different place, but he has absorbed the Sumerian outlook on the afterlife, and he doesn't expect a great deal from it. But he's someone who doesn't really expect a great deal for himself in general. He's very sort of hard nosed, but also a bit of a glass half full guy.
I thought Ninshuba fancied
him. I love him very much. Love Haga.
Well, I think Ninshuba did.
But only he was good enough for her. But I really love Haga, and he's one of those characters that grew out of being like when you need a character to like, who's going to pass him their glass of wine, or I need the name of someone to hang Gilgamesh's sword. So you go, hand me my sword, Haga, and then a person appears. So Haga very much like was unplanned, but obviously became a very major character.
I hope we see more of him.
We'll see more of him. Yeah, you definitely will. It's all the old gang, but just more in the second book.
Well, we are excited because we loved this so much. Dark stuff, light stuff, funny stuff, weird sex stuff. We loved it all. We ate it up.
I'm very pleased.
What have you got coming up? Obviously, you've mentioned that this is a trilogy.
Yeah, so book two has gone to my editor now. But the life of a trilogy writer is that I now literally today have started on book three, because this book three will need to, you're always a year ahead. So I have to deliver book three next July, as well as working and also doing the edits on book two. So you can't stop. But I mean, the one good thing is that although, obviously a lot of work, at least when I start, like as I just started book three today, at least, you've got like lots of characters in place in different situations. It's not like you're starting, you're not starting from you can amuse yourself by thinking about whatever the situation is that the different people are in. So that bit is fun. And the work on kind of making the characters come alive in your own head, if you know what I mean, is already done. I already have a good sense of what they'd all do if, which makes it, fun, quite fun.
Where can people go to find out more about the next book and follow you? Support you.
I've got they could buy the book if they would like to travel around in ancient Sumer. I know it's funny, I also spent years in the marshlands of ancient Sumer now. Because it now took years to write, if you know what I mean. And then there's I've got a website somewhere, and on that I'll put up all the journalism I've done about sort of Sumer, and I've got a piece coming out in The Guardian on Saturday as well about Inanna being the world's first literary hero, in fact, not Gilgamesh. And I'll put that on my website, which I think is emilyhwilson.com, if people are interested in the first civilization thing, whatever civilization means, bunny ears again.
We'll put links to that in our episode description so that people can go and read these things. Because I think after reading this book, people will be interested, because I certainly want to read things that you've written about ancient Sumer, because I'm fascinated now because of your book.
And it's really interesting because there's so much, obviously it's fragments, but the in the fragments from Sumer, you know, there are beautiful fragments. Like, that line, you know, like some of the lines that got pulled out here or there from the epic about, you know, the sleeping and the dead, how like they are, and all that. Death so savage who hacks men down. You know, all these great lines from Sumerian myth that are kind of, you know, kind of, well, not just not appreciated, but like not known at all, really. So although they are quite often fat and don't make any, like, what's going on, and quite dark, and also like super fragmentary, there's still within them, like, it's amazing stuff. And I think it's really kind of mind-blowing that Inanna's stories, which don't, if you sort of look at her myths, you don't need a city for Inanna's stories to happen. They're probably much, much older than cities. And to think of her as a prehistoric goddess, and yet we can read her story, is kind of amazing to me. I think it's amazing.
Thanks for hanging out with us today. And again, special thanks to Emily. Follow us on Instagram at Demythifying the Podcast for teasers of episodes and our divings into mythology and historical fiction. If you're liking what we're doing, please rate, review, and share. It really helps us out. She's been Charlotte. I've been Lauren. And today, we've been turning pages with Emily H. Wilson.